You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with lawyer Amy Goldrich. Amy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Amy, I want to begin by saying, as we were talking off record, but just to be clear to everyone listening, because you're a lawyer and we're going to be talking in part about art and art law, I want to be clear that this is in no way, this is no way advice coming from you as a lawyer, and this is not directly about advice in any way. This is about the subject of art law. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah, Amy, that's correct. Yeah. That it's you know, the general principles are, you know, great to talk about, and it's good for people to know, but it's not specific advice tailored to anybody's specific situation. So advice is something that comes from a one-on-one conversation where people agree in advance, yes, I'm giving you advice. So, but we're going to speak freely, I hope.
So let's talk about art law now. Could you define what art law is and your role at the firm?
Sure. You know, art law is, it's really like a giant Venn diagram where a lot of different types of law sort of intersect within an industry specialization. So I guess in shorthand, I usually tell people I have a general practice with an industry specialization, which means that whatever my clients who are in the art world call me about is by definition art law to me, because everything gets viewed through the lens of the art world. But it could still be, it's a contract, or I have a problem with my gallerist, or I have a problem with the fabricator, or I just got this notice from my landlord, what does this mean, or do I need insurance? All kinds of things like that. I mean, it could be estate planning for people who are artists or who are collectors, things like that. So really, it could be anything if it's a question or a problem that comes specifically out of the experience or practice of somebody who's living or working in some way in the art world.
And so it sounds like from the kind of examples that you were just giving that many of your clients may be artists, but is it artists as well as curators, gallerists, museum directors kind of demographic as well?
Yes, I do represent quite a number of artists, but I also represent galleries, and I do work in the fine art shipping and storage area. I do work for not-for-profits. People who work in museums, for curators, all kinds of things like that, all kinds of people.
So you must have seen a lot of, I mean, you're seeing a lot of activity. We're in the art world at a time where there is more money than there has been in the past, and I would imagine, you know, more issues for artists and everyone. When you talk to nonprofits, maybe that's an easy way to enter into this kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. What are artists typically looking for in terms of help from a lawyer like yourself? I mean, you mentioned, you know, gallerists or setting up estate planning, but are those the top priorities that you hear from? Problems with fabricators? These all sound kind of like negotiation issues or contract issues. Is that what you hear most, or is it something else?
Yeah, you know, that was a good observation. A lot of the things I deal with do rotate around contracts and transactions. So business issues. So for artists, when I first started my practice in particular, you know, artists I knew would be like, oh, my gallery hasn't paid me, or oh, my gallery isn't returning my work, things like that. And that is, you know, that's a business dispute, and you have to figure out how to find a solution that's appropriate for the artist, that feels right for the artist, that'll get them, you know, that has the best chance of getting them what they need, but that won't, you know, that they're all worried about, like, oh, I don't want to go scorched earth. I'm worried about my reputation. I don't want to get a reputation for being difficult. And that's a fine line to walk, you know. If you're going to stand up for your rights, people might, there are people who might complain and call you difficult, but, you know, this is your business and this is your life. You can't be a doormat. So
that's such a good point because, of course, that really makes sense to me, and I've heard those kind of things myself. Artists don't want to cause any waves, don't want to create any confrontations, yet the idea of artists not getting paid for work or galleries holding back payments is something that I hear quite often from other artists. That's not an uncommon practice, it seems.
Yeah, that's the case. And it happens, you know, it happens predominantly with smaller galleries, with younger galleries, which makes sense if you think about it. If you think about sort of the economics of the gallery model, if you're a smaller gallery, you're dealing with artists who are younger at the more emerging end, the price point is lower. Your overhead as a gallery is, you know, going to be, even at the low end, you're going to be spending $10,000 or $20,000 a month just on rent and utilities, and you got to pay people to work there, and you have taxes and all kinds of things like that. So there are enormous financial pressures on a company, basically, that has to sell a lot of product every month in order to be able to cover the overhead, right?
Right.
So if you're selling works that are $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000, and you're technically entitled to keep 50% of that, you know, if you have to do, if your monthly nut as a gallery is $10,000 a month, you have to sell $20,000 worth of artwork and collect, not just invoice it, actually collect and get that money in. So I think there are pressures on some galleries that, oh my God, I got to pay Con Ed or they're going to turn the lights off. Or I have to pay, you know, I got to pay my rent or they're going to change the locks on the door. So there are a lot of pressures on some galleries. It doesn't excuse not paying the artist. And, you know, an artist can certainly be sympathetic to these business issues, but at the end of the day, it's, as I said, it's your work, it's your business, and you have a right to get paid. New York State actually has a statute that covers these things, and it was amended a couple of years ago, so it's actually got some teeth in it now, where if a gallery doesn't pay the artist his or her money or refuses to return artwork, the artist has a right under this statute to get a lawyer and to actually sue and certainly threaten to sue the gallerist until the artist receives what he or she is entitled to. And there's even a provision in there for attorney's fees, which was meant to make it easier for artists to be able to get a lawyer to help them.
And the provision for attorney's fees means what exactly? That if an artist hires an attorney and wins a suit, that fees would be part of that suit? Is that what that means?
Right. That if it went to trial, you know, if somebody really was refusing to pay or refusing to turn over artwork and you had to go to court, that the court is able to say, you know, you bad gallery, not only are you required to pay this money, I order you to pay this money to the artist, I order you to return this work to the artist, I also order you to pay the reasonable attorney's fees because this artist had to go and get a lawyer and come to court to get, you know, to get what is rightfully his or hers. Now, very few galleries, in my experience, very few galleries will actually let it get to that point. I mean, most of the time, you know, it's by the time a lawyer's letter comes into it, things get a little more serious, and things tend to resolve. A lot of artists will walk away, you know, they might walk away from some money just to get their artwork back. There are different types of solutions that will make sense in the moment. People generally want to, you know, get it taken care of quickly. As an artist, it really affects somebody's bandwidth, you know, and ability to focus. As an artist, if this huge business dispute is hanging over them, it affects their ability to produce and be creative. And that's, you know, know, that's understandable. So very often artists will be like, let them keep the money, just give me my artwork back. Or, you know, I'll let him keep some of the money and he can keep this one painting, but I want the rest of it. And usually things can resolve like that. But I think it's important for artists to know that it's not a question of being difficult, that the law itself has made a decision about what the artist's rights are.
And what happens when you come into a gallery? Because there's some, I mean, situations where there are no contracts. I was just talking recently to an artist who was going, working with a gallery in New York, in Lower Manhattan, not a new gallery, but one that's been around that sells secondary art as well as emerging artists. And he said, I don't do contracts with artists. I trust everyone.
That's one of those funny statements that sounds really good, but can be problematic. You know, there are different ways to deal with it. Just because there's no written contract, it doesn't matter that there's no written contract. That New York State law governs. Okay, it's there. Even when there isn't a contract, or especially when there's no contract. It even governs if there is a written agreement between the artist and the gallery. If there's a conflict between the written contract and the statute, the statute still governs. The statute sort of replaces whatever the contradictory terms are in the contract. So it's a good thing to know about if you're an artist, for example.
You're protected with or without a contract by state law.
Yeah, it's just because you don't have a contract doesn't mean you don't have rights. I mean, to me, the importance of a contract is that it helps people to understand what they have a right to expect from each other. At the same time, you can still, through emails, through conversations, come to a place where you have a good understanding of how things work. You know, how many weeks after you receive payment by an artist will I get by a collector will I get my check? You know, how often do you account? Do you have insurance in the gallery? All kind, you know, like a whole range of questions. These are things that can be talked about ahead of time. I'm seeing, you know, do you pay for production? How does that work? You know, a lot of artists are interested in having people pay for production. And I'm seeing more from some of my, you know, the smaller to mid-sized galleries that I work with, that there is an interest in having some type of document that will help everybody to be clear about, you know, what is it reasonable for each of us to expect of the other, right? A lot of galleries, for example, will assume that if they're the first gallery representing an artist, that it means that, oh, I'm exclusive, I'm your exclusive representation worldwide. You can't talk to anybody anywhere else. Well, that may have been the farthest thing from the artist's mind. That's a good thing to know ahead of time if that's the gallery's expectations, right? I've seen some rather terrible gallery agreements that require, you know, that said that the artist wasn't supposed to have any curators or any collectors make studio visits unless somebody from the gallery was there. Now, very often it's a really good idea to have somebody from your gallery there. It can be really, really helpful, and it allows the artist to focus on talking about his or her artwork and not have to talk so much about sort of businessy things, which, you know, a lot of artists like. At the same time, nobody wants to feel like they're being sort of, you know, like they're in an abusive relationship, like they can't, you know, like they're being stalked
right,
or something, which is not, that's not healthy either. Somewhere in between the two is important. You know, a gallery has a right to know that you're not selling out of the studio behind them and taking sales away from them when the gallery is spending all kinds of money to help advance your career as an artist. So it's really just a question of making sure everybody's on the same page to start with. If you don't have a written agreement, for example, like a traditional style contract, if you have emails going back and forth where, you know, you as an artist, you're asking questions. And if the gallerist responds to you in an email, you can look to sort of this course of correspondence as being a kind of an indirect line an indirect linear narrative that gets you, that will demonstrate what your understanding was of each other.
That makes sense, and ideally it would be nice if artists could work that out with every gallerist. That's certainly ideal. Perhaps we should discuss a little bit about another issue which you mentioned, which also seems difficult to navigate, which is preparing your estate. I mean, this is something that strikes fear into the heart of most artists, which is, you know, when they're gone, what happens to all their works? I was just talking to an artist, just fairly well known the other day, Ule, who is saying he started a foundation because he was afraid that when he died, his kids would just grab work and try to put it on the market, and they wouldn't know what they were doing.
Well, that's so just wanted... it. You know, we're all going to die, right? Nobody wants to think about it, which is why most people, artists and non-artists, most people don't have wills. They don't make a plan for it because they don't want to think about dying. But I think for artists in particular, and collectors as well, you know, collectors who've spent time developing, you know, building a collection that they really care about, you care where it wants, you know, you care what happens to it. You're more of a steward for it than you are sort of some sort of owner. But for artists in particular, you're absolutely right. There are, you know, there are really two things that an artist will focus on. One is, you know, their name, their legacy, their place in sort of art history, whatever it may be, and then the objects, right? And then there's also whatever was in the studio, or their writings, their letters, their, you know, to the extent that there's an archive. So I guess there's a third element there. Excuse me. Planning is super, super important. If you die without a will, and this is true in every state, if you die without a will, the state will decide who gets your stuff. And this is the truth. This is the case for artists and non-artists. So if you're somebody who's been estranged from your family and you have not made an alternate plan, your family is going to get everything. I think that's what happened with Francesca Woodman, for example. You know, she had a rather strained relationship with her family. She died young without a will, and her family got everything.
When planning an estate, where does an artist start? Because what you began to outline sounds like an enormous amount of work, essentially kind of archiving everything. And as you're saying, what happened with Woodward, where you're, if you don't make a plan, it can just go to, you know, the family or whoever's nearest. How does one start that? Because it sounds like a daunting process that, of course, we all want to avoid.
Well, there are, you know, yeah, it is a daunting process. And depending, but more or less daunting, depending on where one is in one's career. But even at a most basic level, you can, you know, an artist can do, you know, some planning. There are different ways you can go about this. I mean, for most people, calling, you know, LegalZoom or downloading a file, a will file from the internet is better than nothing. But it's not going to allow them to do any major planning, and it's certainly, but it might be better than nothing if you have a strained relationship with your parents and you don't want them to get anything. You can at least accomplish that. But it's better off to just find almost any attorney who specializes in wills can help you with that. There are people out there who do this who are experienced working with artists. And ideally, that's who you want to find. If you live in a place where they have like a volunteer lawyers for the arts, you can usually reach out to them. They may have people who can help you with that. Otherwise, you should just ask around other artists you know, that kind of thing. Because even if an artist thinks that he or she has you know, doesn't have anything of enormous market value right now, you still care about where it goes.
Right.
And a lot of artists take for granted that over the years they may have done barters or trades with other artists, so they actually have a collection of work by other artists, not just their own work. And sometimes that work can end up being valuable, right? And so that's something to be considered. And the big issue is trying to figure out, is there a place that will take my work? Is there a place that would want my work? And that's one of those sort of horrible existential questions that I think keeps people away from planning this. But if you start in advance and you take the time and can think about it, you can find solutions for these things. There are all kinds of, maybe MoMA, you can't just leave it to MoMA and think it's going to end up in their collection. Everything has to be accessioned. The museum has to agree to accept it. But there are lots and lots of kinds of institutions around the country, smaller museums. Maybe there's a gallery or museum that's affiliated with a school you went to, or some other organization that you feel strongly about or you feel good about that, you know, would want some of the work. So but it takes a lot of effort to figure out what that place is and to reach out to them and get that set up ahead of time. It's doable, but it really stinks to be the artist to have to think about these things and go out there and try to find a place for
this.
Let's
ask you this in closing. It is hard, and it's, I'm glad we're discussing that. Is there also laws that are being changed now for the arts? Like in Canada, there are some things that are changing. For example, when artists show in the National Gallery or museums previously, which is not unlike the United States, artists don't get paid to show there. The gallery, or even, I was in the Whitney Museum Biennial, you feel lucky enough to be in it, but you don't actually get paid to be in it. Very often they commission something, and I think I could use the Whitney as an example because I was in it, and there was another artist there who they commissioned something from him that cost $15,000, but they weren't going to pay for it. He had to raise the money for that. In Canada, it seems that's changing a little bit, that some laws have been enacted to actually create certain fees. If an artist is giving the gallery a work, and I mean a nonprofit space, that there has to be a fee. Is there anything like that happening in the United States?
No, not really. I mean, Canada's always been much, much more proactive and financially supportive of their artists. There's a big system of grant making up there, and their local institutions are very supportive of Canadian artists. And, you can have a career as an artist in Canada and know that when that you can get grants and that you can, you still have to be good, obviously, but that there's money out there that will enable you to do this without having to find a gallery that's going to go, take your works to art fairs all over the place. In the United States, we don't really have that. If you're lucky enough to be invited to participate in the Whitney Biennial, I think their sense is your payment is you get to be in the Whitney Biennial, right? And that's
absolutely that is
and it's really on the artist to fund. Now there are people who think, listen, as the artist, you are a manufacturer, and it's your responsibility to, you have to pay the cost of creating your work. Some people are able to raise money, Kickstarter and things like that are great as a way to raise, funds to do certain things. There's a big Kickstarter campaign going on right now for a project called The Truth Booth, which is done by Hank Willis Thomas and some other artists, and they wanted to be able to take it all over the country. And nobody's funding that, and it costs money to do it. So they set up a Kickstarter, and I, at this stage, I think they're actually pretty close to hitting their goal for that. But as a rule, museums It costs a lot of money to run. Some museums have a ton of money, but, you know, most of them don't. And it's wonderful to have an ambitious idea, but, you know, generally they're not going to fund production. Most of them don't have artist fees either. Private commissions, you know, private institutions, they might have something like that. I know some independent curators who, if they're brought in to do a show in a space and they get a curatorial fee, if there's nothing for the artist, which they'll usually put in a budget and very often gets knocked out, you know, I've known curators who will take their own fee and carve it up however they have to carve it up, so at least the artist gets something, you know.
Right.
Geez, if they need to pay for, you know, if you need to pay for taxis to get, you know, the work to and from the venue, you know, you shouldn't have to lose money to show your art is the thinking there. But
exactly.
It would be great if there were, you know, listen, $500 can make a difference to, you know, in a situation like that for younger artists. $500 can be an enormous amount of money. But, you know, in group shows where you have a lot of artists, all of a sudden, you know, it starts clicking up. And
right.
It's unfortunate. I know Marina Abramović has gotten, you know, huge, huge pushback because, you know, she was using all these people to do performances and they, you know, people who weren't being paid because it was just supposed to be this great honor to be able to participate.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Put it on your
TV. So, we see a lot of that in the art world. And it seems to me that, I mean, and this is just my lay point of view, but that there are some laws that can help us. And one of them was, as I understand it, the idea that an artist gets royalties when work goes from auction or to collector.
That's an
idea that seemed to protect artists. I don't know if that really is enforced or works, but that seemed like a law that was
protective. You know, I think they certainly have it in Europe. I mean, that's certainly institutionalized in Europe. We don't see it so much here. They had it in California for a while, and there was a court case about it, so that part of it was essentially thrown out. The problem is that this is something that it protects only artists who have a secondary market. It doesn't help people at that first level. You know, there are other laws that you can look at. For example, New York State has gotten much more strict about enforcing labor laws. You know, a lot of artists, a lot of galleries rely on interns, and New York State has gotten pretty strict and started out doing this in the fashion industry where they were essentially having interns doing, you know, full-time jobs and not paying them. And the state
right.
of New York takes the position that an internship is not a replacement for a position that you would otherwise have to pay somebody for. We don't let you have people work for, you know, real jobs with real responsibilities towards producing your product or service without paying them. So they're much, much more strict now about internships. And like Vogue magazine and places like that, they had to pay back wages to tons of people. Again, this is a situation where artists don't really like to make waves. And there is something to the idea of an apprenticeship. Of, you know, if you're working in an artist studio where you're really learning something, you're definitely getting something out of it. But it's not, you know, nobody's supposed to be abusing the intern system that way.
Right.
So,
right. And as you go around to nonprofit centers, and this is really, you know, in closing, because we've talked about a lot of interesting, helpful issues, when you lecture or talk about law and the arts, is there a common question you get from artists? Is there something that you see as a real recurring problem that always needs to be addressed, or why you see more commonly as a lawyer in the arts field
the one piece of advice that I give in a classroom setting, I mean at lectures or in a classroom setting that I give to people or at a cocktail party or wherever is when you deliver a piece of work to a gallery or to another person, to a place, you need to have a piece of paper to reflect that you gave it to them. So it could be a consignment agreement, but some people are too nervous to do consignment agreements. They don't want to bring up economic discussions because they're uncomfortable with that. You can do something as simple as a delivery receipt on such and such a date. I delivered this artwork with a thumbnail image, dimensions, media, year, if you have an inventory number for it or whatever, in excellent condition, received by, and the name of somebody at the gallery who signs it. That way, there were, for example, after Hurricane Sandy, how do you prove, if you didn't have a piece of paper to prove that something was at a gallery in their basement storage space, and maybe the gallery wasn't as up to date, their registrar was, behind on getting things input into their system, how do you prove you had an artwork there that was destroyed that you should be compensated for?
Right.
How do you prove that, there were terrible gallerists out there? Sometimes people would deliver things to them and then at the end, the gallery would be like, oh, no, you never gave me that. I don't know about that piece. You have to be able to prove that you gave it to them. So even if you make just a delivery receipt, you really go a long way to protecting yourself because you can show that they signed for it and that they had it, that it existed and that they had it.
I like that. So, that's of course, very helpful, and I appreciate that. Sandy, for those who maybe weren't in New York then, that was devastating. In a matter of an hour, a flood came into Chelsea and out and destroyed hundreds or thousands of works of art in the basements of all the galleries.
Exactly. I mean, the insurance company paid out so many millions of dollars that it caused them to change the way they write insurance policies for art galleries. You will never find any insurance coverage for anything with subterranean storage, for example.
Right.
Galleries look at the insurance companies, they look at floodplains. What are the elevation levels? Is the gallery on a hill or is it below sea level? So,
right.
All kinds of stuff like that an artist isn't really expected, to be, that's not their job to know all of that. But you should have a delivery receipt to prove that it was there.
Right.
That's a really good place to start. And that way you won't forget. And they can't pretend that it's not there. So.
And the last question is one that's off topic and a little lighter. Is mm-hmm. there any book that you're reading now, could be related or not related at all to what we're talking about, but any book at all that you want to share with us? Could be anything.
Let's see. I don't know. I have to admit that a lot of the reading I'm doing is to get away from the art world, and I'm a big fan of Sarah Vowell right now. But I think a really helpful book, particularly for artists, I think just for understanding the gallerist and understanding their business, is Ed Winkleman's book on how to run a commercial art gallery. I think that it will help the artist to be a better partner with the gallery if the artist understands the gallery side of the business.
I like that. Yeah, that is a good book, and I'm glad you mentioned that. And the books you read to get away from it all, which I also like hearing, because that's what we all do, right? The books
right.
that were off topic were mysteries, right? Julie Vowell, you said.
Sarah Vowell, she's kind of like a, I guess, narrative nonfiction historian, humorist. The last book she wrote, what was it called? Lafayette and the Not-So-United States. And it's a history about Lafayette when he came to the United States and what his experience was in trying to become involved and become such an important figure on the side of the colonists in the Revolutionary War. I went through a phase where I read a ton of David Sedaris. As the art world has gotten so heated and the numbers can be so big and things can be so intense, a little escapism now and then is not such a bad thing. I'll copy that.
I couldn't agree more. That's why I'd like to end on that question. Amy, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.